5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
What do ping pong, TV dinners, and windbreakers have in common?
Was escalation possible before the invention of the escalator?
And what unit of power did James Watt invent?
From the wheel and the compass to the Xerox machine and the motorized ice cream cone, we'll explore the etymology of humanity's strangest creations and most important innovations in this inventive episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are getting innovative on Words Unraveled with some human inventions.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at the invention of the inventions, but also the inventions of the words for the inventions, which is obviously something that we're a bit more into.
Etymology podcast.
But we will get into some of the machinations. I think one of the things we learn is that certain inventions are named after people that we're surprised to find that they were, and that some things we take for granted were originally the names for brands, etc. But anyway, let's get straight into talking about some inventions. And where do we start when talking about inventions, Jess?
Well, we should probably start with the thing that most people consider to be the first human invention, or the more fundamental one, and that's the wheel, right?
Yes. I looked this one up, and I made what for me was a surprising discovery, Jess.
Ooh, tell me.
So the old English for wheel, and actually the way I'm pronouncing it there actually reflects rather well the old English for the word. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, English words that begin WH were almost always usually HW words. They were pronounced hua.
So,
yes, your cool whip is actually, yeah, whip. Might well have been whip at one point.
Cool whip.
But anyway, the wheel in Old English was pronounced hweol or hwegol, right? With a sort of G sound in the middle of it. If you trace that back to Indo-European, you find that it's got a root. So we're talking about going back like thousands and thousands of years to the common ancestor shared by English, but also lots and lots of languages across Europe. You go back to a root, which is Quéclo, right? Quéclo. Quégol, Old English, Quéclo, Proto-Indo-European. Now, the thing that amazes me about that is exactly the same source of the word circle.
Oh, I believe it, yeah.
So the words wheel and circle, despite seeming totally different and despite the objects being identical, are actually related.
And that's also like cycles and things like that as well, right?
Indeed, yeah. The Greek kyklos comes from the same original Proto-Indo-European term as Old English. And what's extra neat about this is that the wheel is kind of responsible for the fact that a word in the British Isles is related to a word from Greece, because it is the invention of the wheel that allows the culture that exists where Proto-Indo-European is being spoken, somewhere around the steppes, to spread, not only because it makes farming better, so those people are more successful, but also because it enables you to physically move people. So because of the wheel, the word for wheel in one part of modern day Europe is related to the word for wheel in another very different part of Europe. And I like that.
Speaking of agriculture, by the way, the word agriculture, do you know the Old English word for the word agriculture?
No. Was it something like mudcraft or something?
Basically that. It's earth tilth, meaning earth tilling.
Oh, right. Okay. So like, yeah, the turning over of the earth, the soil. I wasn't that far off then, was I? So what would one use to do that?
A plow, probably.
Ah, yes.
Which a plow wasn't a word for the tool originally, but was a measure or unit of land that equaled the amount a yoke of oxen could plow with a person in one day.
That's fascinating because another one of our measurements is, means exactly the same thing. Acre. Acre means an area of land that can be plowed by a yoke of oxen in the space of a day. So it means etymologically the same as plow.
Acre is also related to the agro in agriculture. It's field there too. So it's a measure of a field, probably.
That's amazing to me that plow can mean the same thing.
Because plow meant that. It wasn't the tool. The word for the tool in Old English was sul, and it may have been introduced by the Romans because the Latin word for a furrow was sulcus.
I just can't get my head around the fact that we've got two words in English that mean the area that right. a yoke of oxen can plow in a day. That's bonkers.
Speaking of which, the culture in agriculture, it's the same culture as in like cultivating land and cultivating the mind. And the root verb here is colere, meaning to tend or guard or till. It's closely related to colony, the land that is tended by farmers or settlers, originally intended to describe like tenant farmers, a colonus, who went to two areas around Rome to settle new lands. And then the figurative sense of culture, as in cultivation of the mind or manners, came around in the 1500s. Oh, also, it's the same Proto-Indo-European root as the word wheel.
No, it's not.
It is.
Culture has the same root as wheel.
Yeah, but it means to revolve or move around or dwell, the notion of like hanging around something to tend it.
I hate it when there are these sorts of associations. Like,
why? It's wonderful.
Well, I don't understand how dwell and circle can be related. I know you said hanging around, but I don't think they were using the idea of hanging around.
Well, dwell isn't, right? But it means to dwell. Like the word dwell is not related to these.
No, I get that. But you're saying that this Indo-European root means circle and means dwell. Why would it mean both of those?
No, it means revolve or move around or dwell, like to live and inhabit a space, to move around it, not necessarily to move around it. It also meant that.
Oh, man. This is why it sometimes seems like the Indo-Europeans, the Proto-Indo-Europeans, must have only had about five words, right? Because there are so many interpretations of individual ones. It obviously doesn't work like that, but amazing. So I, when we said we were going to talk about inventions, I was thinking sprockets and all right. this sort of stuff. But so far, we've covered soil and circles.
Sprocket is a terribly satisifying word, though.
It is, isn't it?
Sprocket. It's very fun to say.
Sprocket.
I would name a creature Sprocket.
Yeah, that's good.
I do have one more like ancient technology one, like agricultural technology, and it's very brief. But the word mill is also probably brought into English by the Romans. It's from the root verb molere, meaning to grind, which you might guess is related to your molars, your grinding teeth.
Oh, that's very good. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that
and
nice?
Actually, miller and various different translations of it, like the most common surnames in a lot of countries. I think the most common Italian surname, I might be wrong about this, is Molinari, which means...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and in Germany, I think the most common surname is Müller, which is... They both mean
Miller.
Miller, yeah. And Miller is a surname.
Yes,
you've always needed them, right? Because it's how you get bread. Can I take a sidestep from talking about bread then?
Yeah, because let's talk about bread.
Just because. I was thinking about inventions. There was an idiom that popped into my head, which was the best thing since sliced bread.
Right. And when was sliced bread invented?
Well, there's a question. When was sliced bread invented? Well, it was
presumably
invented.
Knives and bread have existed for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, so the slicing of bread, it's very difficult to date that. But
industrial
we do have a date
bread slicing.
For the first, first commercial industrial bread slicer, right? And the first one actually only lasted 6 months. It fell apart. God bless him. Poor fella called Otto Friedrich Rohrweder, right? Who was, he's an American, a jeweler from Davenport in Iowa. But he also liked to invent things when he wasn't jeweling. And in 1928, he invented the first automated bread slicer. It was used in a bakery in Chillicothe, Missouri. So Chillicothe baking company became the first to use a bread slicer and therefore, you know, has the claim of producing the first sliced bread in terms of, you know, pre-sliced bread. It actually fell apart after 6 months, though, his invention. His first prototype, he'd been working on it for a while, was lost in a fire in 1917. So actually, he didn't have a lot of luck with this invention, but at least it has gone down in history as a benchmark for brilliance. So, you know, he's done quite well that way.
If I may brag on my ancestors for a moment, I have the benefit of being related to my great grandfather was an inventor who created a number of agricultural tools, mostly that are still in use. You can find Charles Fletcher Warren and Kathleen Huffman, my great grandmother, on several patents in Google Patents. They owned a peach orchard in the 1930s and they created a basket turner. It was primarily him. We've got the sketches and everything, an industrial ball and socket joint that's still in use. He also developed an early hydraulic hammer, which was used by his business partners. They had a deal with the US military where they would use this hydraulic hammer to smash up roads so that the Nazis could not get to the places that they were trying to go.
Oh, wow. Yeah. He did his bit, didn't he? Wow.
By the way, the word hydraulic, when we say hydraulic, we are always alluding to an ancient musical instrument, much in the same way that when we talk about galaxies, we're always talking about milk. While we have other, obviously, hydro-related words pertaining to water, the full word hydraulic entered Latin and then French and then English from the Greek phrase hydraulikos organon, meaning water organ, a musical instrument. And the word hydraulikos meant pertaining to a water pipe. So the Greek word is formed from hydro, meaning water, and aulos, meaning pipe or flute, which is why hydraulic specifically pertains to fluids in motion, often through pipes and spillways involved in tools and powering things, which I think is kind of neat.
Very good.
I don't know.
That is neat. That is neat when you can trace it back to a specific old term.
We should dial back in time. I don't know. The ancient Greek inventions are pretty old. But we should talk about, I think, maybe paper next.
We should talk about the tools of our trade. I mean, they would be. I mean, I can't remember really the last time I wrote something down on paper, to be honest. Jess, I'm more of a
I always a have a notepad type. Next to me because I have to keep my brain in order.
That doesn't surprise me, Jess. That doesn't surprise me. But I would have to ask my wife for a pen if I needed one right now. Yeah, paper. So we know where the word paper comes from. I think quite broadly people are aware that it's a descendant of the word papyrus as such. What's interesting is we associate papyrus with ancient Egypt, you know, rightly, because that's where papyrus was produced. It was where the reed that was known as papyrus was cultivated and turned into paper by, you know, how would you describe that? By interlacing it, right? And then you would write on it. But papyrus, if you think about it, it doesn't sound like an ancient Egyptian word. And indeed it isn't. It is a Latin word for that reed. And in turn, that Latin word for that reed comes from the Greek word for that reed, which was papyros. So actually, we associate papyrus with the Egyptians. The word is not Egyptian by any means. But also, papyrus isn't paper. So, who invents paper? Well,
it's the Chinese. Right? Yeah,
it is the Chinese. Yeah, indeed, we owe them a huge debt of gratitude, specifically to a eunuch named Tsai Lun. You know, does everyone know what a eunuch is? Like a castrated man who has been castrated basically to sort of pacify them so that they can devote themselves entirely to the protection, in this case, of the emperor. But also, he found time to invent paper by mixing mulberry bark, hemp, rags, fish nets, just sort of anything you find.
Fibers.
With water. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Make it into a pulp, squeeze it, make a sort of film out of it, hang that up to dry, and what have you got? You've got an invention that is going to change the world. It is paper. And a great debt of gratitude to Tsai Lun for that.
Wow, that's so cool. I didn't know that. Well, another related word is parchment, right? Which is made of skin, typically, or hide. It literally means of Pergamon, or from the city that is now called Bergama, which is located in Turkey, where parchment was supposedly first adopted and used as a substitute for papyrus in second century BCE.
I definitely thought that it was from parched.
Nope.
Because
you would think,
it's been dried. Yeah, it makes far more sense. It must have influenced the spelling of it.
Can I talk about another Chinese invention?
By all means.
This was developed probably independently. It kind of depends on how you determine like who invented what when. But the oldest compasses were invented in China during the Han Dynasty for land navigation. And they were made of lodestone, which is a naturally magnetized stone of iron made to float in water and point south. And as a result, they were sometimes called south governors. Or in the Song Dynasty, when the lodestones were often made to be shaped like fish or occasionally turtles, they were called south pointing fish. So you would float your little fish in your bowl of water and it would point south. And it was called a south pointing fish.
And proper victory for the southern hemisphere, right?
Right.
The first compasses pointed south.
The word compass itself was originally for mathematical measurements. It means a device that steps together, implying the pacing out of things across a distance, like measuring around the circumference of a circle with a mathematical compass. It means like to pace out. It was applied to the directional tool, which in English-speaking regions was first used in nautical environments, not land navigation like in China, about a century later, probably because it is round and has points like the mathematical instrument. So compasses for navigation are named after compasses for mathematical circle measuring.
So is the pass at the end of compass, is that related to words like path and pace?
Yes. Yes, it is.
We talked about paper. Can I briefly mention the printing press? I know we were talking about sort of ancient inventions and we're not going quite that far back. We are going back far enough, though. We're going back to the 1440s, right? And to Johannes Gutenberg. What does Gutenberg invent? Because they're already printing stuff in China at this point. They've got their paper and they're stamping stuff on it using press machines. It's the method by which you can rearrange these sorts and create movable type that is what Gutenberg invents in Europe and enables us to all have lovely books because they're not having to be handwritten. The number of books published in a month after the invention of the printing press is more than had been printed in the entirety of history up until the invention of the printing press. I don't mean the first month of the printing press, but now we definitely print considerably more books than had ever been written. You know, we probably print more in a day now than had been written in the entirety of human history by the time Gutenberg invented the printing press.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, he invented it because he needed a project to help him make up for the fact that he'd had a failed venture trying to sell metal mirrors. If you know about this, if his mirror business had taken off, we might not have got the printing press and we wouldn't have had the Enlightenment, for example, which is sort of amazing. And we certainly wouldn't have this podcast, that's for sure.
Jess. Oh, certainly not. Yeah.
And so
we've done an episode about printing too, if you want to check that out as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we did go into all of that, but weirdly, we didn't go into this bit. But
no,
so famously, he actually, to start with, he's using it to print indulgences. What it is it's a document entitling you to free passage at the pearly gates into heaven. It's one of the big reasons why the Protestant Reformation happens is indulgences. The idea that you can just literally pay your way into heaven is something that, yeah, Martin Luther greatly objected to. But that's one of the first uses of the printing press, sort of tragically. And then we do get the Gutenberg Bible, which is the first book that's printed using his press. His press is inspired by the presses used by winemakers and olive oil makers. Ooh. And if you have a look at the early presses, yeah, they look just like it. Well, it's not. It's actually, it's twist. Like that. Yeah. It presses down. And that's why it's called the printing press, if you're interested. Every time that we mention the press, we're ultimately talking about
pushing letters
Gutenberg's
onto paper.
Press, because, yeah, exactly. Because newspaper presses, then it's not so much pressing anymore as rolling. Anyway, I only mentioned the printing press because we've got to. It's a wordy podcast.
Could I briefly touch on inventions that are older than you might think?
Oh, yeah, no, please do.
One of them is vending machines, which existed in ancient Greece.
No, they didn't. I'm not having this. I'm not having this. I mean, Socrates bashing on the side of a box to try and get his Coca-Cola out the bottom.
So Heron of Alexandria designed a coin-operated device that dispensed a fixed amount of holy water in temples.
Yeah, right.
There's also batteries from 200 BCE. The so-called Baghdad battery was a ceramic vessel containing a copper cylinder and an iron rod. And some people say it could generate a small electric charge if filled with an acidic liquid, though we don't know what it was used for, so there's that.
Actually, famously, lemons are also passable batteries if you really don't require an awful lot. Incidentally, we should mention the inventor of the modern battery, I suppose, or the pile, as it was called, which was Alessandro Volta, after whom volts are named, which is actually a whole genre of its own, isn't it? Units named after inventors.
Speaking of which, isn't Watt one of those, Mr. Watt?
Yes, it is. It is, yeah. James Watt. I think my surname is essentially a contraction of Watt's son. So I could claim some dynastic inventive pedigree myself at this point. But yeah, James Watt invented... Well, actually, here's an interesting thing about James Watt. He has the Watt, the unit of power, named after him. But he actually invented a unit himself that is not named after him. Because he invented the concept of horsepower.
Oh, nay.
Yeah. Yay. It was a marketing technique. You know, he said, look, if you use my new improved steam engine, you will be able to replace X number of horses. That's how much horsepower his machine has. But no, he ends up having, you know, 1 joule per second named after 1 watt.
Other inventions that were older than you might think include automatic doors, you might say, first century. This is another Heron invention. This guy was insane. He built temple doors that opened when priests lit fires on adjacent altars, and the heat generated steam that moved weights via pulleys and opened the doors.
That's a proper invention.
Alexandria had several. Alarm clocks are also from the 3rd century. So the idea behind this one is it combined a water clock with a mechanism that dropped pebbles onto a gong at set times, which was basically an automated timed wake-up call. Contact lenses are also older than you might think, but also I would never wear the first contact lenses. It is also wild to me to think that, like, for many centuries, people who had poor vision just couldn't see all the time.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? Just accept it and move on and bump into that wall. Yeah, the first contact lens, what's it made of and when was it?
Glass.
That's a relief.
Leonardo da Vinci sketched concepts for these in 1508, but he didn't actually make them. The first ones were made by German ophthalmologist Adolf Fick in 1888 and by someone else in 1888, but I think they were using Fick's model. Fick made and fitted what were considered to be the first successful contact lenses, which were an afocal scleral contact shell made of heavy brown glass, which he tested on rabbits and then himself, and then on a small group of volunteers. And they were so large and unwieldy that they could only be worn for a couple of hours at a time. I would not be in that test group. I mean, I wear contacts and I just... The glass, no.
His name was Mr. Fick.
F-I-C-K.
That is the German equivalent of a very similarly spelled English word. Oof. Yeah, so there we go. I've worked some etymology into it.
And then toilets with flushing mechanisms date back to like 2500 BCE. The city of Mohenjo-Daro had brick toilets that connected to flowing water systems, which is pretty dope.
Precedes any existence of Mr. Crapper, let alone notwithstanding the false association.
Have we mentioned Mr. Crapper? He was a sanitation worker, but he doesn't have like a patent for a toilet, but he does have patents for other things. And the word crap certainly predates, and Crapper came later, but not related to him because nobody at the time had ever heard of Thomas Crapper.
Yeah.
But crap is older than his name too, so.
Yeah, the story comes around because of the convergence of the word crap and the existence of a sanitation worker called Crapper.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. tap one you don't use, and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3. Create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Should we speak about other proprietary names for things that the and trademark death?
Yeah, because I've got a good crossover one here because I was surprised to find how old the escalator is.
Oh, I love this one. This is one of my favorites.
Because escalator is a proprietary name, which seems amazing because it is such an accurate, well, I mean, I take it for granted as an accurate description of what it is, right? You think, oh yeah, if it takes you up, it's escalating. So it is therefore an escalator, which may well have been the logic applied by Jesse Wilford Reno when he invented. Actually, he didn't. No, this is not true. He didn't invent the escalator, did he?
No, he called it the endless conveyor elevator, and it was Charles D. Seeberger who coined the term escalator. The implication here is that the word escalate didn't exist until after the invention of the escalator, which is hilarious because we use it in terms like describing warfare, like escalating tensions all the time, but we wouldn't have said that before the late 1800s.
That's amazing to me as well. So the first escalator was not called an escalator. As you said, he gave it various names. He called it moving stairs, the inclined escalator. This is 1892 invention by Jesse Wilford
Reno. His patent is called the endless conveyor elevator.
Okay, there we go. Mm-hmm. And it's first installed on Coney Island as an attraction for a couple of weeks. Thousands of people turn up to go up and then presumably come straight back down again. And then it's tried out on the Manhattan end of the Brooklyn Bridge. They put it there and people have a go on it there for a bit. But the first sort of proper use for it is in Bloomingdale's, of all places, which is kind of interesting. And then Otis, which is a name you will still see on, I don't know if you'll see it on escalators because you don't tend to be confronted with the brand name on those as much. But if you get in a lift, you'll often see, well, I often either see Schindler written on the lift, which is always funny because it's Schindler's lift.
Schindler's lift.
or Otis. Otis is still a big brand in machines that take you higher than you currently are. And they had the trademark for escalator. And they bought his design, bought his company. And it became, to start with, a branded product called an escalator, which
I love that.
Really surprised me.
A couple of other sort of mind-bending chronology terms around this would be that, so escalate didn't exist before the invention of the escalator, but we did have a verb escalade, which was not the brand name of a Cadillac SUV, but was used in the 16th century as a word for scaling fortifications with ladders. And that brings us to the root of all these words, which is it's related to scale, as in to scale a cliff or a wall, and it's related to an Italian word for ladder, scala.
Well, also, I mean, the French for a staircase is escalier. It's basically a moving escalier.
Originally a word for a ladder, then a word for stairs, then for scaling anything, and then we've got all this.
Yeah, scaly thing.
But speaking of things that lift you up and down, the word elevator is probably a lot older than you would think, like the 1600s. And at that time, it meant a person or a muscle that lifts things, elevator muscles, which we still describe in that way today. And then in the late 1700s, that was extended to inanimate technology like wood grain elevators, which are quite old.
Right.
And although escalate is a back formation of escalator, elevate is not a back formation of elevator. It predates the word elevator by about a century, but elevate may be a back formation of the word elevation, which is recorded yet another century before that.
Goodness me. I mean, elevator to pick me up off the floor after all of that. It's called a lift anyway. It's a lot simpler, a lot shorter. Lifts you up, doesn't it? It also lowers you down again, but no one ever talks about that, do they?
We don't call it a de-elevator.
Well, I mean, this is the interesting thing because like one of the first proper applications of the elevator is to take you down into the New York subway.
Right.
So it really was a de-escalator. What would you call that? A descender.
Most people probably know that things like Kleenex and Band-Aid are genericized trademarks or proprietary eponyms, which is another way of saying that. Bubble wrap, ping pong, and TV dinner, I think, were the most surprising ones to me. There's also breathalyzer, jacuzzi, rollerblade, super glue, windbreaker, and zipper, too.
Those are all quite well known, but you've really blown my mind with the ping pong one. I know that it had an alternative name in England, Whiff Waff, which is a fantastic name for it. It's on a mutt of beer.
One more that gets me, too, is the word moxie, as in, like, you've got moxie, kid. It's the name of a soda, and it still is the name of a soda. You can buy moxie soda still in some regional grocery stores around here. But it was the name of a soft drink, and it's originally from a Native American Abenaki word meaning dark water. So the soda is named after the rivers and that are called that. And it was marketed as moxie nerve food.
You've got moxie. Was that some sort of slogan for it, or are people just invoking the idea that you've got a sort of bubbly spirit or something?
Yeah, the word moxie in general for like bubbliness and for like the way moxie makes you feel. It wasn't necessarily a slogan, but it was borrowed from the soda.
It's interesting that you mention zipper, because zipper was used by the company Xerox. So you know, Xerox is in severe danger of trademark death itself. Trademark death, by the way, is just when your trademark brand name loses its capital letter because it becomes so generic. In fact, they sometimes call it genericide. You know, it's when basically it's become so widely used for something that is not specifically your product that you lose your trademark, you lose control over that word. And Xerox was very scared of this happening. So it actually ran a public facing ad campaign telling people not to use Xerox as a verb, right? And one of the slogans it used on this was, if you use Xerox the way you use zipper, our trademark could be left wide open.
That's very funny. I feel like in order for that death to officially die, people would have to use Xerox machines more often than they do currently.
But do you know where the word Xerox comes from? Do you understand the sort of etymology of that word?
Xerography is an older word.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. So basically what photocopying was called, because before we called it photocopying, was xerography. And the zero at the start of there is from the Greek for dry, because you're not using wet ink. You're using this dry powder to print these copy after copy after copy after copy. So it's just heat, dry powder, essentially sort of melting it onto the page. It's pretty cool. And also what comes out is dry as well. Dry to the touch immediately and lovely and warm on your face usually.
I feel like the word Xerox sounds like the sound that a Xerox machine makes.
Another of the slogans used by Xerox, by the way, was, when you use Xerox the way you use aspirin, we get a headache. Because aspirin is also a proprietary name. It was formerly owned by Bayer, the big German pharmaceuticals company. But again, you're not going to see it written with a capital A anymore. Having said that, Xerox is, by the way, the Russian word for photocopy. I've got another proprietary name, if I can just mention one, because we're talking about them in different territories. So this is a surprise to people in Britain and a lot of English-speaking parts of the world, but maybe not a surprise or not even worth mentioning to people in America. And that is that the word biro is a proprietary name. More importantly, it's the name of the inventor. In fact, Laszlo Biro is the inventor of the ballpoint pen. And in England, we call a ballpoint pen a biro.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Well, so his surname is Biro, but he wasn't born Biro. He was born Laszlo Schweiger in Hungary, right, in the early 1900s. But his dad, he's born into a Jewish family, right? And I don't know how much you know about Europe in the first half of the 20th century, but not always the best place to be a Jew.
Not the pen production.
That's what it is that there's sort of this rising anti-Semitism thing going on. His dad's very keen for them to Hungarianize, as you could describe it. So he changes their name to the Hungarian word for judge, which is biro. His dad's an inventor, and he invents a pen as well. He invents a pen where you can use water instead of ink, which is kind of interesting. There's like dry ink in it, and you fill it with water instead of liquid ink, so it's a bit less messy. But anyway, it doesn't really take off. But his son does a better job, and is credited with inventing the ballpoint pen. Others had invented something almost identical before, but he's the first person to nail the combination of having a ball at the end of your pen and also having ink in it that is neither so thin that it just sort of seeps out and blots, or so thick that it dries up inside of the pen. It's brilliant. It's inspired. He releases to the world this idea of his ballpoint pen. He's called it the Go Pen. He's been working with his brother on it. And all of a sudden, World War II breaks out. Hungary's Nazi-allied government is cracking down on the country's Jews. And so he and his family, they move to France. Then France gets invaded. So he has to move away again. And he moves to Argentina, where finally he manages to bring his product to market. And it's under the name Birome, because he's working with a local guy whose surname begins with M-E, me. So in a lot of Spanish-speaking countries, a ballpoint pen is still called a birome. The reason that in England it's called a biro is that one of his first big sales is to sell tens of thousands of his ballpoint pens to the Royal Air Force. So for the very people fighting against the people he's had to flee Europe to escape. And it turns out that they're really good for use in planes. So the navigators are using them because they work at high altitude.
And oh, yeah.
What are they using? Uh-huh. Oh, they're using one of these biro pens. And from that up until this day here, we call it a biro. But what do you call it in America?
Mostly just a pen, but yeah. I would say the equivalent would probably be Bic. If someone were to say, like, what is the most iconic or recognizable pen brand, it would probably be a Bic.
Well, there is something almost identical happening with the Bic, but you have to fast forward a bit to the 1960s, and it's a French baron. His name is Marcel Bich, B-I-C-H, but he does start the company Bic, B-I-C. He really perfects the ballpoint pen, and he produces this model called the Cristal, which is, when you think of, well, what we would call a biro, but the sort of archetypal ballpoint pen, this transparent pen where you can see the ink inside, it's got like a little sort of golden nib with a blue lid, another little blue plastic bit at the other end. That is the Cristal. It is one of the best-selling consumer products of all time, over 100 billion of them sold. And yeah, that's the reason that you might call it a Bic, and that they call it a Bic in French as well.
This isn't exactly etymology related, but it is a little bit fun to see what lies in the archives of the U.S. Patent Office, because there are some really obscure and strange and occasionally, at least in retrospect, funny inventions and patents in the U.S. patent archives. One of them, for example, invented or patented in 1965, is an apparatus for facilitating the birth of a child by centrifugal force, which is a spinning delivery
spinning
table that
uses spinning someone around until the baby like comes out.
Rotational force to fling the baby out of a birth canal into a safety net. There's also
into a safety net. Well, I mean, I suppose it's better than not into a safety net.
There is an apparatus in 1994, there is an apparatus for simulating a high five in case you are sad and don't have anyone to share your wins with. You can get a mechanical arm on a spring-loaded or make a mechanical arm on a spring-loaded pivot that slaps your palm back when you need to high five someone.
You've got two hands. Most people have got two hands.
Maybe you don't have two hands.
Fine. Then I'm okay with them buying it, but I don't think the market, I would suggest the market's not big enough.
There's a motorized ice cream cone, which is a battery-powered cone that rotates the ice cream so your tongue stays put and the ice cream turns.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I want to be able to relax with my ice cream. I don't want the effort.
There's a leash for a snake, which I bet herpetologists and snake owners probably would find a use for this.
No, a snake is all neck. Where are you supposed to put it?
A snake kind of, its body is kind of a leash. So maybe, I don't know how this works. There's also a, I don't know how this one works at all, but a life expectancy timepiece, which is a wristwatch programmed to count down your approximate remaining lifespan based on personal data and mortality estimates for your demographic.
No, I mean, a smartwatch could really easily do that now, right?
Yeah, probably. With all this is 1991, so.
Yeah, I'm impressed they came up with the idea back then. Then, but maybe that's something to resurrect now.
And then finally, the sanitary device to prevent male genitalia from touching the toilet water, which is a
touching the toilet water.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know. I don't have this problem.
I can understand like not touching the rim. I don't want to give too much away about myself. It's quite a long way down to the actual water, and the water's back a bit. I mean, you really got to be packing for that.
Or you know,
required. Oh, how does it work?
It is a stilt seat that is raised up and an insert, so they hover above the bowl. I'm sure it's been a problem for someone before.
It sounds like some. Yeah, I mean, if that happens to you once, you're definitely looking for a solution for it.
I would think that the solution would be squatting. But hey, if you are disabled or something like that, then I could see it being
so very accommodating.
Having a niche. Anyway.
Okay. No, I'm glad we went there, Jess. I'm so glad we went there.
So
no etymology involved.
Could we close out with the invention of the word invention?
Yes, we simply should. Is it an old, I mean, it's got to be a French word, right?
Well, it's a Latin derived French. Yeah, totally. It's a Latin word. It's from invenire, which means literally to come upon. So it was more about discovery than devising something necessarily originally. The context we see it most in English is discovering the remains of saints as holy relics. This came to be associated with the feast called the Invention of the Cross, which celebrates the stories of the third century finding of the true cross, which typically centers, there are variations, but it typically centers on St. Helena, the mother of Emperor Constantine, who, at least according to a few accounts, went to Jerusalem to find the Christ's cross and is made aware of its location by a heavenly sign. And she tears down the temple of Aphrodite that's been built on top of it and finds three crosses. And one of them cures a terminally ill woman. So invention originally meant physical discovery by searching for something. But earlier in Latin, invention was a rhetorical term, the process of locating arguments from laws and precedent and history. So the five components of rhetoric, along with invention, were arrangement, style, memory, and delivery. So originally discovery, and then it became discovering ways to create things and processes that solve problems over time.
Right, okay.
Another Latin word that's close to the modern use of invention is the word figment, which literally means something invented, formed, or fashioned. And in English, it came to also include things that were like made up stories like myths and fables and deceit and falsehoods,
right.
Hence figments of imagination, which were far more tangible things in Latin.
Right. So it's an invention of your imagination, mm-hmm. Quite literally.
Another neat one here is the word machine. In Latin and Greek, it meant a device or a tool or an engine or a contrivance. But in English, it was a word for any structure. In 16th century English, machine was, in some of its earliest senses, used for any large structure or system, including the whole world as a constructed frame. And the OED has a bunch of works from the 1500s describing the whole machine of this world divided into parts, the celestial and the elemental. And it's not talking about like the functions of Earth. It's just that's the whole thing. And that kind of smacks of the device called a deus ex machina, which in Greek is God from the machine. But that was way more literal. It was like literally like lowering a person dressed as a god via a machine crane over the stage.
The word engine itself is actually quite an interesting one as well, because an engine, we use it now to describe technology, but its essence isn't really in technology at all. But it is about things that more figuratively drive things.
When you say a gin, like a cotton gin, it's a machine for separating cotton from seeds. It's short for engine. And the word gin has actually been used for other machinery since Middle English and even in Old French. which is kind of cool. Yeah. But it was especially used for war machines and torture devices.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Engine, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. This is all coming back to me from when we did our episode about trains, planes, and automobiles as well.
I think we may have also mentioned this in our alcoholic episode because we mentioned that it's not related to gin, the drink, which is not. From a word meaning juniper.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. On that tasty note, is that a good place to end?
Yeah, let's do it.
I've enjoyed this one, Jess. You've enlightened me about so many things that I had no idea about. The idea that to escalate comes from the escalator, which in itself is a word invented by a man in the 1890s, is kind of amazing to me.
I've had people get angry about that when I've said it before. Like, they're like, no, escalating tensions have existed forever. And like, probably, but we didn't call them that.
Escalating tensions. That sounds like a journalistic cliche to me. So I have no difficulty in believing that that is a modern invention. Should that be innovation? Innovation is a better representation, actually, isn't it? Because that is the idea of generating something new, right? That's the ultimate meaning of to innovate, right? Thanks for joining us for another episode of Words Unraveled.
We'll see you next week.